Hello, everybody, and welcome to Anything But Traditional. I'm your host, Tamar Ben-Tzvi, and I'm so happy that you are here today to listen in to this week's episode. This week, we have an incredible guest. We have Flatbush Girl, and I'm so excited for you guys to hear this awesome episode. It is Gavaldic. It was really, really awesome talking to Flatbush Girl. I learned so much about her. She has such an interesting, unique background and perspective. Where she's coming from is just, it's really incredible to see how she developed over time. Of course, we hit on the mikvah strike. We even speak about Rav Schachter's approach on it and Rav Schachter's writing. So definitely make sure to listen until the end to catch up on that. And we also spoke about her fertility journey. She even shared some tidbits that supposedly she had never shared before. So tune into that. And I can't wait for you to hear it. So without further ado, Adina Sash, a.k.a. Flatbush Girl. Welcome to this week's episode of Anything But Traditional. I'm here today with Adina Sash, a.k.a. Flatbush Girl, the Jewish activist. She has over 60,000 followers on Instagram and is just incredible. She's very, very vocal about her opinion. She's not shy. There's been a lot of talk about Adina and her initiatives in the past week or two. So she's here to tell us all about it. But first, we want to hear her story, who she is, how she got into activism in the first place. In my humble opinion, I have to say that Flatbush, do you still live in Flatbush?
Yes.
Yeah. So I have to say that my brother-in-law's from Flatbush. And I don't think that this is a crazy thing to say, but I feel like Flatbush is like as in town as you can get, you know? Like, people from Brooklyn don't even know about Queens, you know? It's like, okay, what, five towns? What are you talking about? You know, you grew up in a place that's very traditional, but you're in anything but traditional for sure. And I'm very excited to have you on.
Thank you. I guess, you know, my first attempt into activism was really about 7 years ago, right after I had my youngest son. I really wanted to get into social media and do something productive with a platform that was meaningful and helpful to the community. And I just figured, you know, why not talk about the things that I think a lot of women struggle with, which is sort of this like discrepancy between being the builder of the home. You know, the home is reliant on a woman's perseverance and her being an Eishes Chayil, and she's the backbone of the home. And yet a lot of decisions and executive decision making is very often in the male space. And so, you know, as women, we're a matriarchal society, like, you know, Judaism is through the mother. And I just felt that in so many ways, we were being oppressed while also being held to this like very high, like we were held in such high regard, but in other ways, not held highly enough. And I felt that that discrepancy was something that needed to be spoken out about. And I started off talking about women's representation in print, you know, Ami, Mishpacha, a lot of very ultra-Orthodox. It's not even very ultra-Orthodox. In Flatbush, we have the Flatbush Jewish Journal, which is a clear representation of Flatbush standards. You know, it's not that divided. Women here are driving. They have higher education, lawyers, doctors, therapists, real estate agents. And yet at the very same time, their faces are not allowed in print. And, you know, that led me to align with a lot of activists like Shoshana Keats-Jaskol from Chochmat Nashim.
She was just on the podcast.
Wonderful. And Avital Goldschmidt. You know, from there, I was really able to see that there are so many other fields of advocacy that women really need. And that's how I got started.
Wow. That's really amazing. Are you Syrian? Like, you grew up in Flatbush. How did you get to Flatbush?
I'm in Flatbush because one set of grandparents lived in Flatbush. One set of grandparents lived in Bar Park. So I sort of had this like fusion of like a Hasidish upbringing and a more yeshivish upbringing. Maybe in my DNA, I have ancestors who come from more Syrian backgrounds, but I consider myself to have grown up almost like a fusion between Hasidish and Yeshivish. And in that way, have felt that my voice is relevant and that I can make commentary on things happening in both of those spaces.
I know that you are very, very passionate about what you do and why you do it. And I definitely want to hear a lot of that. But I also want to hear, like, who you are, where you grew up, what schools you went to, what your family was like. I feel like, you know, if you can give us a glimpse into your childhood, that would be incredible.
Sure. So I went to nursery and pre-elementary school in Bar Park. I was constantly surrounded by the Yiddish language in Bar Park. My mother and like my maternal side of the family has a lot of Satmar and Hasidish connections. Not necessarily did they identify as Satmar, but growing up and living within the Satmar community is something I was always exposed to and felt safe and at home and friendly with that sect. And then I went to BYA Elementary School, which is in Flatbush.
Is that Beis Yaakov Academy?
Yeah, Beis Yaakov Academy. I went there for elementary school, had wonderful teachers, wonderful principals. I think the level of Yahadus and Limudei Kodesh studies there were really a cut above the rest.
Wait, can you just fill everyone in? Because I'm in Israel and I definitely feel like I had to be like, what's Yahadus? That is like Yahadut.
The Jewish branch, the Limudei Kodesh. I always felt like I was being taught by very empowered and very strong-minded women, and they set an example for me on what it means to have like a full ownership of your Yiddishkeit. And then I was the only girl from my elementary school to go to Manhattan High School for Girls in the city, where my principal was Rebbetzin Asaf, who is also an extremely empowered and vocal and sort of alpha Rebbetzin. And these leaders really shaped my understanding of not necessarily taking a back seat to my frumkeit. And I've been very much inspired by them. I don't know necessarily if they're proud of me or not. It's very possible that they think I'm very misguided and I've taken things very out of context and I've gone too far and I haven't used enough nuance in the way I speak and that I'm almost, you know, being misunderstood and leading people astray. And that's possible. But nevertheless, they are still very inspirational to me. I'm the oldest in my family. My mother had me when she was 20 years old. I was raised by a very young set of parents. I was constantly surrounded by tons of family. My uncles, my aunts, we all lived within a few block radius of each other. And then I have three younger brothers who are in the yeshiva system.
No wonder you're so vocal.
Yes, I'm the only girl. I'm the oldest and only girl.
I feel like you had to be vocal against your brothers and be like, that's mine, get away, you know, especially the oldest. Oh, man, my oldest sister is like intense to me, you know, so like I can understand being the oldest of three brothers.
Yes, exactly. And I mean, I'm the oldest grandchild from both sides. So I think I always felt a little bit of like pressure. There's some literature that's been written on how oldest and especially oldest grandchildren, like I feel like a lot of pressure just, it wasn't coming from them. It almost comes internally. It's like this duty. I feel an intense duty to do what I can to further my community and help Jewish women of my community. And anyone who doesn't see it in that lens, that's all right. You're allowed to make any determination you want. You're invited to join along or you're invited to criticize. Whatever works for you, but I'm very proud of where I come from. And it is precisely my passion and dedication to Yiddishkeit, which really helps me make all my decisions.
Wow. No, for sure. So is everyone in your family still living in Flatbush?
Almost everyone is still living in Flatbush. Yeah.
Like your brothers and your parents and...
My brothers, my parents, my husband's parents, my husband's siblings, my... Everyone, it's like we're a Flatbush family. We are a Flatbush family.
Wow. That's crazy. Like, did you ever think about moving out of town?
Never. Never. Flatbush is never. My home. Brooklyn, born. How you said, like, oh, they don't know what Five Towns is. They don't know what Queens is. I'm the same way still. I'm like, once you're in Brooklyn, you don't need to go anywhere. You don't need, there's, everything is here.
What about Israel?
Of course, Israel. Of course, of course. Israel is my homeland. Israel is my homeland. Libi b'mizrach. During the height of COVID, I made a bar mitzvah during one of the times where Israel was shut down. And the bar mitzvah was set to be, he was supposed to put on his tefillin, on his bo bayom, on Tu B'Shvat at the Kosel. And we were inching in, and we were supposed to do like a 3-week tour of Israel leading up to him putting on his tefillin at the Kosel. And Israel was shut down. It was considered a red zone, or maybe America, we couldn't enter. And we were waiting for our Ishur and our ability to enter. We were working with different, I forgot the name of the nonprofit organization in Israel that was helping with this. I can't remember at this exact moment, but they were trying to help us speak with legislation to allow us to come in. And every single day we waited with our luggage at the front door, hoping that we can get on a plane and go to Eretz Yisrael and to be able to have my son put on his tefillin at the Kosel and to just infuse my children with a love of Eretz Yisrael. It's the greatest privilege. And I mean, for those of like, for you or your listeners and for you for living there, I mean, my immense gratitude to you for everything you do to hold down the fort for those of us who are stuck in, you know, in, how do you refer to it again? You know, in the Exodus. Yeah, in Chutz La'aretz, but like Chutz La'aretz, like I'm so appreciative of what you do.
Yeah, thank you. Well, I don't do much, but we, you know, we try to just live life here. It's been my dream since I'm 5 years old to make Aliyah. Like there was never a question in my mind of if I was going to make Aliyah. Fun fact, I never went to seminary. So it's not like, oh, I went to seminary and then I decided to stay. It was like, no, no. My entire life was leading up to me making Aliyah. So you grew up in Flatbush. You were saying that you're the only one that went to Manhattan from BYA. Why is that? Like, was Manhattan more to the left than BYA?
It really wasn't more to the left at all, but a lot of my teachers actually tried to fearmonger me out of going. I have very vivid memories of my teachers pulling me to the side in the hallway and saying, you know, if you go to Manhattan High School, you're going to lose that sort of Beis Yaakovness. And, you know, they're more modern. They're coming from different like places. I was really told that I really shouldn't go to Manhattan High School and that it's too modern. And I mean, looking back, it really doesn't make sense. I mean, Manhattan High School for girls is as Beis Yaakov as it comes. The only thing is that maybe it's not as homogenous in terms of the hashkafa because girls are coming from all different areas of the tri-state area. So it's a little bit more diverse and you have to have a little bit more nuance. So when I went to Manhattan High School, I mean, I really, you know, didn't understand why my teachers had planted so many seeds of fear in my mind because not only was the principal such an incredible example of a empowered, somewhat Hasidish. I don't know exactly her background, but she lived in Borough Park and she was fluent in Yiddish. And, you know, it was extremely, extremely Beis Yaakov-y and all the way to the right. And then all the girls coming in maybe had different hashkafas because they were coming from different areas of the tri-state area. But there was nothing not Beis Yaakov-y about Manhattan High School for girls. So I was very happy. The high school did wonders for me. I had an amazing grade. We were a very unified grade. And a lot of us were like just a little different out of the box. And a lot of us were very creative. We weren't a very academic grade. We just always had a lot of fun. And then I got married right at, I was a senior Kala actually. I got engaged right out of high school. I didn't go to seminary either. I got engaged 6 weeks after I graduated.
How did you meet him?
So I know him from childhood. My mother's sister, so my maternal aunt, married his older brother when I was very young. We met like at weddings and family simchas. I never really looked at him in that kind of way. But then once I was in high school and he was in Beis Medrash, things shifted a little bit. And I was a very, very good girl. I was of the belief that if you find the person that you want to spend intimate time with, that there's no time, there's no fooling around. You get engaged and you get married right away. I was engaged by 17. And I was married 3 months later. I was married 18 and 3 months when I got married.
When did you have your first child?
So that was something that, you know, I was very worried about because I wanted to get married, but I didn't really want to have a baby. And the idea of going and asking a rav for permission to be on birth control when there weren't any children already, this was 18 years ago. 18 years ago, it was still considered somewhat questionable for a good Jewish-based Yaakov girl to ask a rav for permission to go on birth control so that she can spend time bonding with her husband or maybe going to college a little bit or, you know, just focusing on her marriage. And it was not so easy for me to get a heter to be on birth control. But I had my first child at 21 and have had my own fertility story with miscarriages, but I had my first child at 21 and then 6 years later had my youngest. I have two boys and I'm a very proud mommy of two young feminist men.
Oh, wow. You have two boys.
15 and 8.
Could we touch on your fertility journey or is that not something you want to talk about?
Yeah, sure. For sure. You know, part of what I think was also very traumatizing for me, not only having to ask for permission to be on birth control and needing to like get renewal on the heter every couple of months, right? Oh, sure. Okay. You can go on birth control for 6 months, call back in 6 months. We'll see if we could give you another extension. You know, it's very dehumanizing. And I wasn't sure like if it was just me who felt dehumanized. I wasn't sure if there was something wrong with me where like, why was I just not okay with just asking what a rabbi thinks about my reproductive cycles and about my intimacy. And then, you know, of course, it was also very, very challenging for me, like even just sending my husband with bedikah cloths to the rav to get permission to whether I can start counting my 7 clean days on this day or that day was very traumatizing for me. I'm very happy for the women who feel that it never bothered them. What's the big deal? Or maybe like, where's your emunah? Where's your emunah s'chachamim? You know, for me, it was traumatizing. And then when I finally went off birth control and was ready to have my first child, I didn't know that I had an underlying issue called factor V Leiden, factor 5. Which basically means that your blood is more prone to clotting. And then my first pregnancy, which I was debilitatingly sick and nauseous and lost 20 pounds, could not lift my head off the pillow, ended in a sudden miscarriage where from one day to the next, there was a heartbeat and the next day there wasn't. And it was determined that it was because of clotting that I had no clue about. The miscarriage, it took a terrible toll on me. But the number one reason why it took such a strong toll on me is because I was mortified about the fact that if my next conception were to be a boy and I was right on the threshold and cusp of when you can still have a pidyon haben or not, right? Is it still considered keter rachem if you lose your first pregnancy? And I was so distraught over the fact that I would, depending on what my next conception would be, if it were to be a boy, and then I would have to do a pidyon haben according to public opinion. And then let's say my rav said, no, it's not considered keter rachem. I would then have to let the entire world know that I lost my first pregnancy to a sudden miscarriage and would have to explain why, how, where, when, what. And it was very, very humiliating. And I had to go to numerous gedolim I remember to this day, I was traumatized. I drove myself around from gadol to gadol to ask if that miscarriage happened at a point where it would be considered keter rachem or not. And some gedolim were like, this is too complicated. I can't paskin on this. Till I got to the right people who told me that, yes, you should make a pidyon haben and you can. And it's very, very dehumanizing. It's very dehumanizing.
The question is, and it's so interesting to me, because one time I went to a shir and we were talking about pidyon haben, and we were saying that like the majority of people don't do a pidyon haben. Like the majority of people between C-sections and miscarriages, like the majority of people don't do a pidyon haben. Like I think Kohanim also don't do a pidyon haben, right? Like it's only Yisrael, right? Maybe I'm making that, right?
Right, it's only for Yisrael.
Yeah. So, like, it's very interesting to me. I also grew up in a very different way. My family is not Hasidic. I grew up very traditional. I went to Schechter until I was in 7th grade, right? And, like, for me, all of this is something that, like, I've never been, like, tapped into. My sister literally said to me, yeah, of course you're going on birth control because, like, mom would kill you if you had a child the first year of marriage. Do you know what I'm saying? Like, it wasn't a question. It wasn't, like, maybe I won't go on birth control. It's like, no, like, that's how marriages start. You go on birth control for a year or two, and then you, like, try to have a kid. My parents didn't try to have kids for the first 4.5 years of their marriage. Yeah, it's so interesting to hear this perspective. But in terms of pidyon haben, like, why the embarrassment? Because I feel like so many people would, like, not have a pidyon, especially with C-section.
So because there's stigma, the women of Klal Yisrael have done such an incredible job over the last few years on social media in literally empowering each other, coming together and destigmatizing and removing shame around things that shame should have never been on in the first place. And the world I was in 18 years ago was a very different world. The pre-Facebook, pre-social media world was a world where the voices that were at the top were the rabbinical voices that were writing and authoring their opinions. And the spaces for women to organize and unite amongst each other were not as strong as they are today. I mean, and also in the secular world, there's been a lot of stigma about fertility and miscarriage and a lot of shame that women carry for no reason, as somehow it's their fault.
You're right. No, for sure. I guess like in Flatbush, do most women have pidyon haben?
So it's not as much of how many people have a pidyon or not. It's more about if you're part of Yisrael and your first child is a boy and you're not having a pidyon and you didn't have a C-section, then it must mean that you had a significant miscarriage before that child. And instead of it being your personal information, which is my personal, I was not in an empowered state where I could say, yes, I had a miscarriage. And possibly, you know, was on the cusp where it's debatable of it, whether it should be considered petarachim or not. Right. By the way, part of the reason why I even chose my firstborn son's name, Reuven, is to symbolize sort of how Reuven, the Bechar of the Shvatim, in some ways lost his Bechora because of how he was silent during the injustice of Yosef being sold. Wow. So that's sort of where he is the Bechar, but potentially not the Bechar, and also the call to action of standing up for injustices, to me is like, I guess you could say the Ruach HaKodesh I got as a mother, where I felt that was a name that captured that moment in time for me as a person, where I felt like there was an injustice going on around me. I had to pick a side of whether to be quiet or not. And also this question of petarachem or not petarachem, which caused me tremendous tsar throughout the 9 months of my pregnancy. And then especially when I found out it was a boy, literally driving around from gadol to figure out if it's okay to still have a pidyon and what's the definition and can they analyze the sonogram from the fetus that, you know, passed away, and can they this and can they that? You know, to me, the name of Reuven is emblematic of that conflict of what does it mean to be a firstborn and what does it mean to stand up for injustice? And that's how I picked his name. I mean, I've never actually said this anywhere publicly, so you have the first exclusive on that.
Wow.
But yeah, so it's not so much how common is a pidyon haben, but more about the questions it invites from strangers in the community about, oh, did she have a pidyon haben? She didn't. But did she have a C-section? She didn't. Did she have a miscarriage? Why did she have a miscarriage? What did she do that caused the miscarriage? Is she not fertile? Is there something wrong with her reproduction system? Maybe we shouldn't do shidduchim with that family if there's fertility issues in her genes.
Wow, that's insane. Especially as an oldest child who had three young brothers, right? Like the shidduchim question was probably like a actual question that you were concerned about, meaning it wasn't like, oh, your siblings, they're all married and you're the last one. Like, you still had three brothers that were going to be going through shidduchim. Wow. It's interesting because we went to a very intense doctor today, like one of the top notch specialists in Israel. And right before we got in, we saw a Haredi couple. And I went to my mom and I'm like, it's hard. Living in Ramat Beit Shemesh without kids, it is hard. But I cannot imagine being Haredi and having to deal with it all. I can't. I'm like, how is somebody that's Haredi supposed to deal with it all? I just, like, it's mind-boggling. Like, the stigma is insane. Yeah, there's just so many things that it's so hard.
Part of how I had a successful pregnancy with Ruvane is that I was on Lovenox injections. First of all, I was on progesterone suppositories for the whole first trimester. And then I was...
I hate suppositories.
Yeah, it was not great. It wasn't...
Can we just talk about suppositories for a second?
Sure.
Suppositories are like, women are punished enough if they have to take suppositories.
It's true.
Because suppositories are like the worst punishment anybody could ever have.
I don't know. I think the needles of the Lovenox injections are way worse, especially when you have to do them twice a day.
So interesting. So I take intramuscular progesterone shots, and I so prefer them over the suppositories.
Oh, wow.
So I guess each person to its own.
Was years ago. My son is 15, but then I also had to repeat all those regimens with my second son, Jack. And then being on Lovenox, I was on Lovenox twice a day throughout the second and third trimester. Obviously, at the end of like 34 weeks or 35 weeks, I was switched to heparin because the half-life is shorter. So in the event of an emergency C-section, there's less concern about hemorrhaging. And it was extremely difficult. It was, you know, people take for granted just having a nice, easy, effortless pregnancy. And it was definitely not that for me.
For sure. I mean, I definitely understand pregnancies not being easy, and getting to pregnancy, I definitely understand not being easy.
And now I'm a doula.
Oh, that's awesome. Wow. You want to come to Israel and be my doula when I have a baby?
Yes, I would love to. Sure.
That would be awesome. Okay, so you had one miscarriage, then you had your Ruvane, and then you had how many miscarriages between your Ruvane and Jack?
Like two or three, but after the first one, the rest were just, they were not as traumatic for me. It was painful and it was sad and it was difficult, but it wasn't as gut-wrenching as the first. When I always felt like I tried to really have a positive outlook, you know, and now when I look at my son, Jack, I say I would have taken 10 more miscarriages in between the two of them. You know, it's that exact sperm and that exact egg is exactly what I would have wanted. So thank you, Hashem.
Wow. Wait, so how did Jack get his name?
So his Hebrew name is Yaakov. He's named after my paternal grandfather, who passed away within a year of Jack's birth. And I just felt that I wasn't necessarily that close with my grandfather, but I always, meaning I saw him all the time. I saw him almost every day. Yeah. But, you know, he was from an older generation and a different time. You know, he wasn't like so warm and cuddly, but I always had so much respect for him. He did a lot of Tzarchi Tzibor. He was very involved in building up the Bustin Rebbe in Boston and in Har Nof, and had a very strong influence on supporting their yeshivas and supporting a lot of yeshivas in Lakewood. And so I just always thought of him as a doer and, in a way, an activist with his wallet. I mean, he died penniless, but throughout his entire life, he had come into significant funds, which he always used to support the community. And I just always felt that, you know, my son, Jack, I first of all wanted my father to have that nechama, that he had just lost his father and he would have a namesake very quickly. And I just felt that it was also just an homage to someone who does whatever activism that they can to help further the Jewish community and to support Torah learning. And, you know, people ask me all the time, they say, you're such a feminist and you're so into the women of Klal Yisrael. Don't you want a daughter? And I say, no, I don't. Because in this community that I'm in, which I don't want to leave, I do not feel that we are in a healthy space right now for daughters to be born. I really don't. I think that the way women's liberties and creative expression are policed is dangerous. And I feel specifically about being a potential aguna. Everyone is a potential aguna. And there isn't enough policy. Even in Israel, there isn't enough policy. But especially in Chutz La'aretz, there's even less protocol that can help mitigate it. And the halachic prenup is, yes, one of the things that we can do to diminish the number of agunot, but it's also not, you know, it's not bulletproof. And there's a tendency for a lot of the batei dinim here in America to, unfortunately, operate based on what's best for their bottom line and for their wallets than for what's in the best interest of the woman.
For sure. No, I hear that. That's so interesting to me. I guess I'm curious, why don't you want to leave the community if you feel that it's so unjust to women?
Because I love my community, and the parts that are unjust will just become more and more corrupt, and I'll be abandoning my from Jewish sisters into a system that they might not be empowered enough or have enough resources to whistleblow about. So I'm using my privilege and I'm using my resources to stay exactly where I am and to push back so that other girls are not trapped in a system where no one is fighting for them.
I hear you. I hear you. So when you were growing up, did you feel like you had anything crazy happen in your life until, like, you got married and the miscarriage and all that? Like, was there anything that made you an activist, or you weren't so outspoken until you got older and had that miscarriage?
I mean, I wasn't outspoken until I had my second son. So I really wasn't that outspoken until 2017. I was maybe outspoken around the Shabbos table or around my network of friends, but I never really took to a more public platform to share those opinions until like 2017. And then there was just a lot of, you know, secular movements around women's empowerment, like the Me Too movement, or, you know, women understanding what consent was, and women maybe breaking out of more traditional gender roles. And so it definitely had an impact on me and inspired me to see how those things might be relevant to my own neighborhood. And I felt brave enough to be able to speak about it. Of course, my fearlessness has gotten more and more fearless over the years. And I'm not always completely fearless. Sometimes it's hard and sometimes it's very challenging. But, you know, I definitely have sharpened my bravery and have gotten more and more outspoken since I started in around 2017 speaking about these issues.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, if I leave, then when will we have another female who understands what's going on in the Beis Din system and is willing to use their platform to speak out about it in detail and whistleblow on aspects that might be a bastardized version of what it actually says in Gittin? For example, there's something called a psak chayev legarish. The batei dinim are supposed to be able to issue a decree or psak of, we examined the details, we heard both sides, he must give a get. It is rarer and rarer as the years have gone on for a Beis Din to issue a psak like this. It's becoming more and more extinct. So when people tell me this is how it is and you can't change halacha, that's not true. The batei dinim are the ones who are changing halacha. They're becoming more and more machmir in a way that is hurting Binos Yisrael.
Right. No, for sure. I definitely hear that. So in terms of your activism with agunot, what inspired you? Like, did you have any agunot in your family, in your friendships? Like, what was the first thing that was like, okay, I'm going to get into agunot?
Definitely, you know, if you recall, Chava Shirabani, I think, was the first viral social media aguna. Dalia Oziel pioneered the Pink Out Wednesday, the Free Chava movement. She really, I think, helped a lot, thousands and tens of thousands of Jewish women to understand what an aguna is. And she made it not so scary, and she made it palatable for a typical from female mind. And she sort of got me into it. And I started to learn more and educate myself more and have worked alongside other aguna advocates over the years. And I'm at the point now where I actually have freed over 18 agunot.
Wow.
Who were not just starting their divorce or something, but were in a trapped marriage where they were either waiting for a year, 2 years, 4 years, 6 years. I just freed an Aguna last week who was an Aguna for 6 years that no one in the YU community was able to crack this case.
Wow.
And I spent hundreds of hours and thousands of dollars of my own money to free this Aguna.
So how did you do it?
That's confidential.
Oh, sorry.
But the way to free an Aguna, the ones that I take on, the cases that come to me, right? People take on different cases. My specialty is a severe, severe case. And the way that I've seen success is not by doing pink out campaigns. It's beautiful. It's beautiful for mass impact and mass education. That is phenomenal. But the way that I try to free an Aguna is by taking matters into a very, it's a battleground. It's a war. You have to go to war. You have to have a war room. You have to have people around the table who are each going to take on a different aspect and a different avenue. And you need to be project managing and you need to be delegating. It's not that much different than obviously not real war, but it's not different than any type of strategy where you need to get something done and you have a main goal. And very often things like, please, thank you, let's work together. Those things don't work.
Okay.
But doesn't work.
The sex strike, right? So I want to talk about the sex strike now because I think that this is a really good time to mention it. I personally didn't fully understand the sex strike, and I'm definitely much more understanding. You know, I love Shoshana Keats Jaskell, who's very supportive of it. I know that it was your idea, I believe. But I don't understand, and I think that, like, this also goes into another question I have, is, like, the sex strike, right? What does, you know, Shelby's marriage in Netanya have to do with Kimberly's marriage in San Diego? Why should Shelby not have sex with her husband just because Kimberly is an Aguna?
So Shelby might be the next Aguna. She doesn't know that she's not going to be the next Aguna. Shelby's daughters, her sister, her mother could be the next Aguna. And she might not be aware of how things work in the Beit Din system to understand how at risk she is. And when we as women have found greatest impact, it's when we have stood up for each other and seen that sometimes we have to stand up for each other. We have to protect each other. So going on a sex strike, first of all, is a way of empowering women to understand that your body belongs to you. Of course, yeah, we have to. It's a halacha to go to the mikvah and you can't reunite with your partner. But what if you are feeling very unsafe about marriage in general or your position in your marriage? If you ever wanted, not you, a person ever wanted to initiate a divorce, right? What if you're feeling unsafe as a Jewish woman that you might not be allowed to have sex for years when stuck as an aguna in limbo, which also means you can't have babies? It's not just about pleasure. It's about your reproductive schedule being monitored by men. So it's a call to action. It's a battle cry and an invitation. No one is being forced to do this. It's an optional strike. I cannot force women to partake in a strike, but it's an invitation to recognize that you can decide if you want to push off your mikvah night for a night because you feel unsafe around your partner. Or maybe you can decide that mitzvah night is not al harig v'al yavar, right?
Yeah.
For that night. The woman gets to determine how pleasure works in her relationship.
Great.
And I don't see how anyone right now can turn a blind eye to the suffering of someone like Malki, who's an innocent 29-year-old Aguna for 4 years. 4 years. And it's not like she didn't do what the Rabbanim told her. She has gone to 5 Bezdins. Each one has issued a different document that states, not Chayev Lagarish, because Chas V'Shalom, we should say Chayev Lagarish, because like I told you, that document is becoming extinct, but things along the lines of, it's impossible for them to have Shalom Bayis, it's a mitzvah for him to give a get, and then other documents that show that he is Mesarev Ladin. So the goal of the strike is an invitation for all women to reanalyze their own relationship and their own autonomy and their own bodily agency over their sexual lives, and to recognize that maybe they have sexual autonomy, or maybe they do have a partner with who they're able to explore pleasure and bonding with. But take one moment, take one day, or take a month, or take a set of time that you feel comfortable with or that resonates with you, and take a stand and say 1 minute, I have privilege, but my Aguna sisters do not.
Right.
And the reason that we don't have enough change in this area is because not enough men care about it. So the women who advocate for it just sound like flaming leftist feminists who are woke with progressive agendas, who want everyone to have abortions. And we are trying to recruit men and to say to them, you are B'nai Torah. You're the gender through which policy is made and through which policy is shaped. So how can you sit back silently while the Batei Dinim have completely stopped issuing something called the Psak Kfiya? Psak Kfiya, which was monumentally actually paskined by Rav Mendel Shafran recently from Eretz Yisrael about David Wasserman, a Psak Kfiya doesn't exist here in Chutz La'aretz anymore. And when you don't have a Psak Kfiya, then people say, oh, if you apply pressure, then it's a get me'usa, and the get's not kosher. And then when she gets remarried, her children are mamzerim, and she's really still married to him, even though she got a get, because the get is pasul, because it was pressured. And if there would have been a Psak Kfiya, then it wouldn't have been considered pressured. There's so much red tape around a woman's womb that if you don't see the Aguna crisis as a forced chastity belt on your Jewish sisters, who not only can't bond with someone and have that safety net, but also cannot reproduce and have more children for Klal Yisrael, then I'm sorry, that woman who says, this has nothing to do, this is destroying Jewish marriages, don't involve me, that perspective is not a Yiddish pintle yid. A Pintala Yid says, Kol Yisrael Arevim Zeba Zeh. A Pintala Yid understands that the woman is the vehicle through which B'nai Yisrael grows. And to sit back and say, but I'm having good sex and I'm happy with my mikvah night, it's very, very selfish.
Great. No, for sure. For sure. I think that the thing that I was thinking about today was Miriam Hanaviah, right? Like, Miriam Hanaviah is known that she went to her parents and her parents didn't want to continue to have children and be together and whatever. I think that they wanted to get divorced. And Miriam was like, no, no, you guys have to stay together. You have to continue. And then they ended up with Moshe Rabbeinu. And when I think of Nishim Sadkaniel, right, I think of those people that, like Miriam Hanaviah, continued that legacy, right? Continued the generations. And I guess my fear was and is, like, if you have the sex strike, right? Which, I mean, the question is, how long is the sex strike going to last? Is it over? Is it still going? Like, what's your take on that?
So the sex strike, from the way I see it and the way I've invited people to partake, is it is a sex strike specifically for Malki. When Malki is free, everyone could go back to their business and, you know, we can then recalibrate and think about how this case moved forward the conversation about Agunot. But in general, this is really a crisis that's happening all over the world. And we've been asking nicely for leadership to take a stance and change things. And they're not doing anything. Great, they're not listening. It's falling on deaf ears. So it's really an act of desperation through which we are, in a way, I guess you could say, in a way, weaponizing one of the skills that we have as women. And it's not that only men want sex and we don't. It's not that. It's that we are saying we're going to deprive ourselves and deprive you as well until you prioritize the safety, the physical reproductive safety of Jewish women. And when you say how long, I mean, if we all took this upon ourselves, I really believe that Malki could be free in one day. In one day. And if you saw the psalm from Rav Hirschel Schachter, he was not a huge fan of the idea of a strike happening on a mass level. And he didn't really like that it was out in the open. Okay, that's not a problem. But what we can gain insight from on his monumental psalm is that he actually dedicates a whole paragraph to the fact that there is precedent for women in tight-knit communities to go on a mikvah sex strike as a way of encouraging their husbands to pressure the recalcitrant husband to give a get. And Herschel Zvi Schachter wrote this in a psak he issued 48 hours ago. And the Benos Yisrael for generations and generations, I mean, hopefully we will have solved this crisis very, very soon. And maybe even solved it from a legislation and a legal perspective. There's a lot of things on the floor in Albany that could potentially give women more leverage when trying to get their religious freedom. But I'm just saying that in the meantime, or in significant cases where there's extreme recalcitrance, because I'm sure we can't cure it forever, but now women have a document where they can go back to and say, oh my gosh, Rav Hirschel Zvi Schachter said that if you're in a tight community and the women of a small tight group say, we're going on a strike together, that you're allowed to do that.
Wow. So do you think that the story of Miriam Hanavia has anything to do with this? Or you, like, I feel like especially because we're in a war.
Yes, I do.
Like I'm saying, like, we're in a war. We need to continue Kwaisal. And then the sex strike, I'm nervous that it is going to prevent future children.
I hear what you're saying, but I think that the sex strike is just a drop in the bucket of the forced sex strike that the Gittin process is forcing upon hundreds, if not thousands, of Jewish women for years. Meaning, so like, for women to take a night or a mitzvah night here and a mitzvah night there to dedicate to free Malki, or going on a sex strike until she is free, right? I think that's a very small amount of time, because I have tremendous emunah that she's going to be free very, very, very soon.
I mean,
very, very soon. But compare that to the hundreds of women whose wombs are under lock and key because they're waiting for a get for their husbands. The unborn children that we should be worried about are not the women who can optionally go into the mikvah or mitzvah night strike or not. It should be on the women whose entire reproductive fertile years are being stolen from them. So I hear exactly what you're saying. It's just that the decree of Paro is not synonymous. The mashal and nimshal for that is not the sex strike or the mitzvah night strike. It's actually the get being withheld and the batei dinim who are enabling that extenuating forced chastity belt on women. So I hear you and you're right, but the nimshal is on the wrong party.
Great. No, for sure. That's,
in my opinion.
No, for sure. That's a really, really good point. Okay. I want to ask you, I know that we touched on it a little bit, but like, if you were to tell your 12-year-old self that this is what you were going to be doing with your life at this point, do you think that you'd ever believe it?
That's such a great question. I love that. Thank you for asking it. I think that I would believe it. I think I've always been drawn to like fiction and young adult novels that have this sort of like saving humanity kind of narratives, like the end of days, or like, you know, Like, I used to read Animorphs as a young girl.
Fave the World.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I always loved reading stories about not even a main character, a group of people who would get together and try to save people from something. And that really always spoke to me. And so I guess I always wanted to embody that. And I think I would believe it. But I think I would believe it. And I really owe all of that to the women who I'm just able to climb on the ladder for rungs that they've already established. We wouldn't be here if not for Sarah Schneerer literally fighting tooth and nail for Bais Yaakov. People have this false belief that she was supported by Dayanim and Rabbanim, and that her ideas were endorsed by the rabbis, and that it was just, you know, it was just an easy thing to just set up formalized education for girls. No, she was divorced. People were spreading rumors about her that she was a lesbian. She traveled the globe with a group of female confidants who helped her set up these establishments in Jewish towns and was shamed for being an attention whore.
Didn't she also not have children?
Yeah, and she didn't have children, I believe. I think you're right. So I'm saying, like, she had a very hard time. And then when we think about, let's say, Judge Ruchi Fryer, Supreme Court Justice Ruchi Fryer, who is the first Hasidic female judge and now the first Supreme Court justice. Yeah. When she started Ezra's Nashim, and even till today, some of us look at her like, wow, look what she started. But she has gotten so much pushback, so much rabbinical pushback, just to advocate for the tzniyus, of Benos Yisrael. She has been fighting for the dignity of Benos Yisrael, and all she has gotten is threats, pushback, people suing her for trying to open up an ambulance corps. So, you know, there's this misconception that women who have made change are, you know, welcomed in by the male establishment and that they give them the resources to do what they need to do. Because as long as they cover their hair and dress modestly, yes, we're going to help you. No, it is not true. No change has ever been made. And I don't mean change as in modernization. I mean change as in a return to the way it used to be. Shifra and Pua helped the women of Klal Yisrael have their babies. They were not forced to go into an ambulance with men who learn with their husbands as chavrusas and daven with them in the morning in order to have their babies.
For sure.
And, you know, the idea of Sarah taught the women. Avram taught the men. Sarah taught the women. So Sarah Schneerer going and making Bais Yaakov systems, maybe now we see the beauty of women teaching women, but at the time when she was starting this, at the turn of the era, it was a return to our birthright. It was a return to the way it used to be. So I don't mean change in a modernization way. I mean change in terms of de-bastardizing things. The kisuba is meant to protect women, that if a man decides to leave, that she should have money to take care of herself until she gets back on her feet.
100%.
Do you know that almost no women get that payout from the ksuba anymore? It's part of the negotiation piece that the dayanim do with the husband, where they say, they tell the woman like this, listen, he really doesn't want to give a get. Let's give him whatever he wants. We're going to give him what he wants and then we can get the get. So sell your house, even though your father paid for it, sell the house, give him the money, forego the money on the ksuba.
Oh my God.
Don't take any assistance for tuition or weddings or anything for your children, because then he's not going to give you the get. And make sure you still pay for his car insurance policy for the next 3 years, because he still needs time to get back on his feet. And women are being extorted for their freedom. And the Batei Dinim are helping the men do this, not necessarily because they're all corrupt. I'm not saying they're all, because some are corrupt, but a lot of them just don't have any other leverage. They don't have anything else to use. So instead of them issuing a psak chayiv lagarish or psak fia or leading demonstrations, the person who has to pay the price is the woman.
But why would anybody do that to the woman. I don't get it. Like, why would anybody do that to her? Maybe I'm just naive, and I probably am, but, like, why?
So I also didn't understand it until recently. There are some really scary people out there. There are some people who don't have the ability to do cheshbon at nefesh. There are people who don't know how to de-escalate.
Like, are they all just narcissists?
Yeah, narcissists, or sometimes it's either, it can be narcissism, and a lot of times it can also be mental health challenges where they're just disturbed. They're disturbed.
Great. No, for sure. It's just, it's so crazy to me. It's so crazy to me.
Yes.
I don't know if you can share any specific cases. I mean, not by name, but is there one specific case that maybe you could give us a little bit more insight into what you deal with, what you work with, like what you work on?
Let me think. Yeah, so a lot of women have been starting to reach out to me who want to get divorced, and they are positive that their husbands are not going to give them a get. And they reach out to me before they initiate the divorce process. And they tell me, Adina, I need to get out of here. I can't live like this anymore. I'm being financially abused, emotionally abused, whatever it is, right? And I'll say to them, unless you really feel your life is in physical danger, you need to stay for a little bit because you need to build evidence. Start recording your calls. Wow. Start taking secret videos. Start taking pictures, because we need to amass a file that if we need to go to court or we need to go to Beis Din, that it is very, very clear that you are a victim over here. Because if you don't have that evidence, the first thing that the Batei Dinim are going to say is, try for Shalom Bayis. Try. Sit down for 12 sessions of Shalom Bayis counseling. And if that doesn't work, then we can start to discuss how we can maybe start working towards the get. But it takes a lot of time. No. A get should not be used as a bargaining chip. A get is not leverage. A get should not be at the end of marriage affairs when everything else is tied up. A get should be up front. Anything else to negotiate. Child support, child custody, assets, alimony, anything else. That is a separate situation that you can either do in Beis Din, preferably in Beis Din. We have a rabbinical, beautiful Jewish court system for a reason. And you have to sign a shtar berurin so that it actually sticks. It's not like you're just there for fun. It's actually binding. It's an arbitration agreement that's legally binding. Oh. Or you can go to court. It should not be that a marriage is a subservient woman getting permission from a man. It should be like two business partners that the business didn't work out. They should separate and they should get all of the details wrapped up. But it should not be that she can't go find another husband or have intimacy. She feels like there's a gun to her head while she's doing all the other end of marriage negotiations, because at the end of the day, she's desperate for her neshama to be unshackled. She's a faithful Eishes Chayil. She does not have the ability. She has so much emunah that she waits for her freedom and she doesn't take matters into her own hands. She stays trapped until she's released. And we're taking advantage of some of the most vulnerable, most observant women, the women with the strongest emunah and the strongest emunah skachamim and the strongest bitachon are the ones who are being taken advantage of and exploited for their dedication to Torah.
Why do you think that those are the women that are going through that the most?
Because otherwise you would have someone like me who says, if my husband wouldn't give me a get, I wouldn't care. I won't care. I am not going to stop myself. No. I will not allow my freedom to be determined by a man. It's not going to happen.
So what would you do?
By the way, those are the women who get freed the fastest.
Interesting. So what would you do?
What would I do? I would just say, you also can't get remarried. You have to wait for me to accept. I'm saying, my point is just that the women who are the most innocent and docile are very often the ones who are taken advantage of the most, who play along with the system, who don't fight back, who don't ask questions, who don't argue, and they're taken advantage of, and there's no one to fight for them. And they give up everything. They give up everything.
Wow. Do you ever get paid for any of this work, or is it all volunteer?
Sometimes I do different cases in different ways. Some cases are completely a chesed. Some cases there's an askin in the community who gives me a budget to work with and says, please do what you can with this amount in terms of getting legal help, bringing in, a mediator, a divorce specialist, contract writers, whatever it is. And in some cases, I take an hourly rate because I don't know how long it's going to take me. And once I start, it's very hard to stop. If you stop in middle, then all you're doing, it's almost like if you take antibiotics and you stop after you become not symptomatic, it's like the worst ones grow back.
For sure.
So it's like once you start with a case, you really have to see it through to the end. And it's not sustainable for me as a woman to be able to do this without any compensation.
100%.
I mean, and I think, by the way, there's a lot of shame that's being done that, like, if you monetize off of this, then you're just greedy and money hungry. I think that's a very misogynistic, sexist thing to say. Shaklanim take money. Lawyers take money. Doctors take money. It's my time. It's my skill. It's my energy. And I don't want to be a shmata.
You're right, 1,000%. And you're teaching these women also to not be a shmata, right? So you have to stand by what you believe. Okay, so we have two last questions. So the first one is, do you have any favorite pasukim or quotes that you live by that mean a lot to you, like that you say to yourself every day, or any favorite pasukim or quotes?
So two of them I'll give you. So my name is Esther Adina. And Esther, the pasuk you say in Shmona Esrei is Ela Varecha Ela Basusim Anachnu B'Shem Hashem Elokeinu Naskir. And very often when you
Aria Kempfler,
oh yeah,
Ela Varecha Ela Basusim. Yeah, go on.
I know him in real life, so I think it symbolizes the kind of emuna you need to have when you're dealing with a recalcitrant get withholder. The term is basically that, you know, water erodes stone. Very often when you're advocating for an aguna, it feels like you don't really have the right tools to go up against such extreme corruption. And I don't just mean with the Beistins, even just from the get withholder, like such strong abuse, such stubbornness, akshanus, and like a kshe oref that is just, you know, really, really disturbing. And, you know, you feel like when you're working with the tools of light, right, like going a little bit and a little bit and a little bit, like you just feel like it's never going to work and it's never going to free the aguna. But we have to remember that water erodes stone. And when it comes to freeing an aguna, it's not only about just getting the get. It's about every little drop in the bucket that we all can do and contribute to help free her.
1,000%. Besides for Agunot, is there anything else that you're as passionate about? I'm so curious now.
Yes, of course. Anything having to do with women and Orthodox women and their freedoms. As I told you, I'm a member of the first all-female ambulance corps, Ezra Snashim. I'm a doula. I service the Hasidish community.
Cool.
And I am, like I said, an avid activist for representation in print for women's faces, especially the cookbooks, which show women's skill set and their food and all their recipes, but they don't show their faces. And it's really, I think, dehumanizing for women.
100%.
And just in general, just giving women more of a voice, and not that they should feel like the only use that they have in their community is either that they're, you know, just that they shouldn't feel like second class citizens. 100%. And just because someone doesn't feel like a second class citizen doesn't mean she doesn't have sisters who maybe feel that way. And we should do everything we can to help.
100%. So do you have any other concluding messages? I know that was an awesome concluding message, but if you have any other advice, tidbits, any other last words?
Well, Tanis Esther is National Aguna Day. And if you could please have in mind all the Agunas and, you know, reach out, see what you could do to help free Malki. There's a fundraiser page and some phone numbers of leaders in the community who might be able to have a healthy influence on the family to finally give the get. And we appreciate your support and free Malki. We should share in Simchas very soon.
Amen. Wow. I'm so happy that we're getting it out this week, right before Aguna Day. That's really exciting.
Yes.
And then last, is there anywhere in specific that people could reach out to you if they wanted to talk more? They're just go on Instagram to Flatbush Girl. Is that the best?
Yeah. I answer my DMs pretty well, like pretty frequently.
Yeah, you're awesome.
Thank you. And you can also reach me at adina@flatbushgirl.com, ADINA. But yeah, DM is also a very easy way to get me. And if I don't respond, then just keep bumping it up, keep tapping, you know, the heart button so it comes up to the top of my inbox.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you so much, Adina. It was so nice talking with you, hanging out with you.
Stay strong. Stay strong.
I mean, thank you so much. All the best. Bye.
All the best.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode of Anything But Traditional. I'm so happy that you took your time and we're here, we're listening. It really meant a lot to me. I think it's really important to talk about Agunot, to talk about the work that Adina does, to understand the mikvah strike that she created. You know, it went viral and I just thought that it was such a unique perspective that she had, and that it's important that we don't judge, that we understand more, that we, you know, that people have reasons for things, that people, you know, have reasons that we don't always understand, but sometimes we have to be a little bit more patient and try to understand. So I'm so happy that you guys were here today. I'm so happy that you listened to this week's episode. If you want to have an ad, a sponsorship, definitely feel free to be in touch. And I am so happy that I am able to share my website today. My website has launched, so go check out talesof.com,
tales-of.com.
And I look forward to hearing your feedback. Please leave a review on Spotify, Apple. I would really love to hear from you. You can also check out my website where you can also leave reviews. And if you want to work together in terms of podcasting or writing or social media, let me know. Reach out. I'm so happy that you were here today. So thank you so much. Until next time, all the best.